Review, review, review.
Ba 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 bum bum.
Review, review, review.
Ba 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 bum bum.
Review, review, review. Re review, re review.
With me and you. Ba 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 bum. Welcome to our Time to Show Up review episode, where Natalie and I take a deeper dive into last week's interview.
If you hadn't had the chance to listen to that yet, you might want to check it out before listening further here. It'll make a lot more sense that way.
That's right, because in this episode, we will be talking more about the theory behind the material that came up in that interview so we can better understand the elements that were going on there.
We'll also be suggesting reading, practices, and models that may help listeners like yourself who are experiencing resonant challenges and opportunities in their own lives.
In this, our first season of Time to Show Up, we're making all of our content freely available to the public. But in the future, these review episodes will only be available within our subscriber community.
Members of this community will have access to all Time to Show Up content, plus additional resources, materials, access to online forums, live events, and small groups.
Since we know that just listening to stuff isn't usually enough to facilitate desired change, we've designed this community to give you the support you need to take your learning even further. And if you join us at the start of our journey and sign up before April 5th, 2024, we're offering a no-strings, 3-month membership for free at timetoshowup.org.
That's right. And if you choose to stay on with us, which we hope you will, we'll give you a 25% early bird discount just to say thank you. If you're tuning in after that April date, don't worry, you can still try out a free 2-week membership with no obligation. There are different packages to choose from, and you can find out more and get in touch at timetoshowup.org.
So without further ado, so now we're just coming away from our talk with Hamid, and we've been reflecting on that a bit together. And there's a lot resonating for me around that, particularly around how different speaking to him was from speaking to a lot of our other guests. And I wonder if that was your impression as well.
Yeah, it had a different rhythm to it. And a sense of exploration, and perhaps like I experienced it almost like islands within a sea where you could find resting places. And it was kind of being taken on this journey and weaving things together in a different way that sometimes people are quite kind of systematic, or there's like a ding, 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 ding.
Yes.
Not always, but sometimes. And this felt more like a wandering.
It was very thoughtful, wasn't it? And I think, you know, Natalie and I have discussed a lot that first question about the mythology, you know, what's your creation myth, and whether people will understand that question, whether they'll respond to it. And I thought it was, and people have responded to it in very different ways, but I appreciated Hamid's thoughtfulness and that there was this kind of almost like a visceral pushback in the beginning, like, and coming to understand that. Actually, I want to say something a little bit about the background to the question. So for me, the background of that question is Carl Jung's amazing book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which is an autobiography that he calls the myth of his life. And I remember the first time I read that, I was like, what a cop out. Like, come on, like, okay, we can have our myth, right? And then we don't have to own up to all the shitty things we've done or like, you know. But as I've grown older, I kind of see he's kind of talking about that as an expression of a truth through a story rather than a narrative, which is these are the things that happened to me, which is also a myth in a sense, right?
Yeah.
And I Hamid's pushback and what we came to find there is he didn't want to be reduced to a story of I was born here and then this thing happened and then this thing happened.
A named sequence of events.
Yes.
That were kind of, well, written down in language. I think that was the other part as well, is like how much of a life can you transmit through words?
And how we're so used to grasping that story, right? And he resists it. I think he resists it in his work. And I think that's why the conversation was different. Because it was almost like, well, let's elude the graspability of these things.
Which is also interesting because as a musician, obviously, when we write music, we use words, but you have music to carry the meaning, to enhance the meaning of the words, to conflict with the meaning of the words. Like there's a whole, words are just one tiny part of musical expression. And so I found that particularly interesting, which was, you know, what's that which is not being said, which cannot be captured by the story that we're telling. So the kind of creatureliness, the embodiedness, the viscerality.
I love that creatureliness idea.
And it's true. And when he talks about the baby wailing, and that, I mean, that really struck me, because in music, you, and in our primate kin, you hear sounds of grief. You hear, you know, an elephant. It's not something that is unique to our species. So there's a sense of being able to transmit something which is more than one transmits in words, but we transmit it through sound, through reverberation, through gesture. I found that thread particularly rich, especially because we're in conversation, right? So, like, you know, we're using words through the medium of a laptop to try and get to the heart of things. So to kind of bring that name in and bring it into the conversation.
And he brought in some very difficult theorists, right, who talk a lot, like Julia Kristeva, who's this French analytic thinking, really, like, I find it very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is an acknowledgement that you're trying to put language on something that's unlanguageable, and that you can only keep approaching, right, without ever getting
this asymptotic, like, you kind of get close to the edge, but you never quite touch it.
And I find that, like, you both kind of pushed back against my, I kept saying, you know, none of the musical was like note in my soul or whatever, you know, it's, of course not true. But it makes me think about how, like, really important deep personal differences, right? Like, for me, my expression of my feelings and my ideas and myself are so wedded to words. Wedded to words that it's kind of almost incomprehensible to me. I can understand it, right? That it would emerge as music or emerge as dance first. Whereas it feels like Hamid was saying that this expression comes first and words are really problematic.
Yeah.
And how we have to bridge that to communicate.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's funny, it makes you think of and our comfort with different modalities. And being forced to engage in certain modalities because those are the dominant modalities. So I was thinking about this, one of the first challenges to language I had when coming to Barcelona. One of my dear friends, who's an extraordinary musician and artist, Blanche Ellis, she also does illustration, and she is incredibly embodied in the sense that she moves in whatever way she feels she wants to move. She dances. And when we were at art school, one of the ways that she would engage with people is through movement. And, you know, she's British. I was born in the UK too. And we're sort of standing there in this sort of little bubble where norms are not quite as tightly held as they otherwise might be. So it's a lot less stiff upper lip in this art school. And she would come up and express herself through physicality, through moving, or like, I'm asking her how she is, and she might give me a gesture. And I remember viscerally in my body being like, fucking hell, what are you doing? This is so awkward. And now it's second nature. It depends on the context. I mean, I wouldn't do that on a stage necessarily. But there's also this kind of, you know, what are we most familiar with? What are we resisting? What are we missing out on by sticking to our lane and saying, well, okay, well, I know how to use words. That's as far as I'm going to permit myself to express the interiority of my experience. Like, I don't know, there's something really, and I don't think it's necessarily courageous. I think it is also that, but natural about the way that Hamid was expressing his longing to make known how he feels.
And to learn about that, like, he went and sought out these theories to put words around this inexpressible stuff. And I think he does that really, really well.
Yeah.
And I think what's also really rich and fascinating about this conversation is the way in which, you know, the first idea is, because of the content of what I'm expressing, nobody's really going to be interested in it, right?
Quite self-deprecating.
In a way, yes.
To a fault, I mean.
Yes. But also identifying that, you know, singing about same-sex love in Arabic might not jump into the charts straight away, right? And then this thing happens. So this thing that's a very personal expression then becomes a very public expression. And then he talks about this moment on the radio at 20 years old where the personal expression suddenly gets attached to geopolitical, racial, religious,
all
of it that he's supposed to answer to.
At age 20.
And how, like, it feels like, and I'm just thinking this now, it feels like a violence.
Right? Oh, interesting.
Yes, that there's a violence to this thing that's out there. And in the same context, to be, not only to be explained away, but to be turned into something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's going to happen in a way. And in a way, like, there's value in that, I think. But the way in which something as a personal expression becomes projected upon, used as an object.
And a vehicle for people to, you know,
promote their own agendas, yeah. Or, and that felt like, wow, that's a lot for someone
for anyone, but
particularly that young, because you're still, because it didn't have all that around it, right? It was this yeah. expression that then, like, and then you said that I needed to research what it was all about.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And I think especially coupled with that extraordinary sensitivity, which, you know, again, I mean, he's found himself at this nexus of topics which are complex and tricky to navigate. And then if you, and I was thinking sort of also, we've had this conversation elsewhere, but when you're in cultures, many of which teach their boys to suppress or cut off their emotions, and then you have someone who is beautifully sensitive, very attuned, creating extraordinary music to transmit something which many people are completely disconnected from, and then having to cope with understanding and holding all of the feelings that you're having in relationship to everything that's going on. I mean, there's just so much there for one person to be able to navigate.
It's painful. Like, hear you say yeah. it, I'm like, oh my God, yeah.
It's really, because, you know, these are all ideologies and ideas until you have someone who's embodying many of these qualities and trying to forge a new way. I mean, that's as if it wasn't enough pressure already. And yes. then someone's living at that nexus. And then I found it extremely moving, the courage with which he was talking about the sensitivity becoming, recognizing that perhaps as a strength and not wanting to estrange himself from that. So coming off medication mm-hmm. and that being the right choice for him at this moment in time, and to feel, I mean, that's courage yes. because who wants to feel the horror of what's happening, but to lean towards that. I mean, for me, I know it's a personal thing, but like the artist, the musician, it's part of that kind of seed is to transmute or to express that which is inexpressible for so many.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about the cost of that, right? Uh-huh. The cost of that for him. And also, you know, he brought up this, and this is a thorny issue that I think I'd like to think about more another time, but this idea on the one hand of neurodiversity. So he's saying, I'm coming from this place of sensitivity, and I'm coming from this place of the way I engage with the world that is different from the dominant way that people engage with the world. So mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's a great fit, like whether that, how that's gendered or sexual orientation or the sensitivity or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Right. And how that's the source of his expression of that creativity and also the cost of it.
Yeah.
Right. And that he needed to come to understand it as a neurodivergent expression, but also not get hung up on the identity of what that is, which is kind of how it was starting to finish, right? Like, don't let somebody give you a name, or maybe you can use that. I can't remember exactly. Mm. And I think it's a really important tension around how we accept our diversity of self, how we might need to name it and work with it in it, but also not necessarily be tied down to it as a, you are this thing, you know.
But also in response to the culture, it's like there's reasons. I remember reading about this as sort of a similar thread, which is people are in ecological grief, and that is a sane, healthy, embodied, mature response to a horrendous situation. And so to hear him talk about, like, you know, this is what I'm experiencing, and it's also in relationship to not just my own particular way of being in the world, my own neurological structures, my personality, my culture, but also the system.
Yes.
And so it's also bringing into question that relationship and what is and isn't working, where there are points of tension, and not just saying, I must be broken, I must be damaged, and there is not, like, we are so entangled. And I think he really pinpointed that.
I think he spoke about that really well. And I think many of the dominant forms of psychological treatment locate the pathology inside the individual in this old school medical mental model, right? And there is some value to that. And we are part of the system. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think the way he located him, almost like this, when I realized that the problem wasn't just located inside of me. And I thought with great generosity, because I know he's received a lot of shit from people, identifying the shit that you're getting from people as located in their completely tangential, accidental arrival in the world from wherever they were. Yeah. You know, they don't misunderstand because there's a willful desire to misunderstand you. They've misunderstood because they've grown up in a culture where the information was this.
There's a generosity to that.
And he struggles with holding the generosity and probably not feeling very generous a lot of the time when, you know, obviously when you're under attack. And I think that's a hard nut to crack. And it's the nut we have to crack these days in so many ways.
But also, isn't that kind of, not the point, but the fact that holding a generous, spacious position, especially when you're being challenged, it's a practice. It's like the idea when people say that love is a verb. It's a choice to act in a certain way, even or perhaps especially when the impulse towards the opposite is so strong that it's something you commit yourself to. And sometimes it's going to work, sometimes it's not. But in the act of making that commitment, it's like if you're thinking ungenerous thoughts about people, the biggest choice is what you choose to do with the thought that's arising or the feeling that's arising. Like that's where character, I think, comes in. All the thing emerges and then you hopefully choose.
Well, there's that famous Frankl quote, right? Between stimulus and response, there's a space and you need to find that. You need to find that space.
And to cultivate that somehow.
And it's hard. And most of the time you find yourself past this. You find yourself in response and then you have to work yourself back to the space. it was really beautiful interview, I felt. Yeah. Very, really, really rich in its indirect meandering way, right?
Yeah. And lovely to actually be, and I hope maybe you guys, you know, may feel this, to be able to enter into conversations and have them take different shapes. So I think one of the things that's important to us is that there is plurality and that we can have conversations in different forms that take us to different places with whatever structures come up. And actually it's the human connection and the exploration that is the most important thing, however that ends up showing up.
We're going to have to, we as a global community have to be so much better at sitting with differences that make us uncomfortable, differences from each other that make us uncomfortable.
And also, and so I speak to my own personality here as well, like not having to get to the point, like being able to wonder and that in itself be its own rich process. So it's also kind of, again, back to those cultural contexts of what's the reason for doing this? Where's the meaning? And not being wedded to a particular formal structure because we think that that's how it has to be.
Yeah.
It's my perfectionism creeping in.
But well, again, it's practice. Just like meandering.
But it's also poetic. But it's kind of like, and I think the framing of it as well, like I'm thinking back to Athene's interview, framing, you know, the perfectionism and the needing to have the answer, framing suddenly the whole thing as play and experimentation. We can find other routes in to meet people if we just reframe sometimes. Yes, this isn't a structure, this is a wonder, this is an exploration. And suddenly, because the kind of the direction or the directive maybe is slightly different, it then opens up that spaciousness to be able to approach in a different way.
For sure.
Anyway, we're kind of going out to the macro. So what are some of the things that we'd like to pull out from that interview?
Right. So for those of uninitiated in some of the high academic theory that Hamid was talking about, Julia Kristeva, we mentioned before. If you're not familiar with the text, I'm not sure if I'd start with a text from her, maybe go for a little bit of aboutism. The Freud essay.
Like,
well, like about Julia Kristeva, like as a first.
Like people talking about her.
Yeah, an introduction to Kristeva, and then you go to the original text because you need to have it explained to you first. Similarly with the second text, which is, I might have mentioned it before, my very favorite text by Sigmund Freud, the one that Hamid was talking about that brought him to tears. Mm. It's called Mourning and Melancholia. It's also difficult, and I'm actually writing a reader's guide to it, so hopefully it'll be out at some point that will help you along, but it's very easily found free online on PDFs. It can really help you understand that one model of the relationship between grief and depression, which I think is a really interesting thing. And I just want you to go for a couple and then I'll bring my other ones in.
So the other thing, and I couldn't find resources on this because I hear folk stories quite a lot as well as reading them, but the Wailing Banshees, if you're interested in those, it's originally Celtic, predominantly Irish mythologies, and you can just have a little look online and find some information in the Britannica folk tales. But yeah, the idea that these fairy folk or apparitions would become apparent when someone in the family was dying or about to die, or there was some kind of omen. Really interesting work, especially in a country or countries or cultures that are so disconnected from grief. The other thing I think also that came up in conversation recently with a teacher of mine was ways in which we do or do not make space and ceremony for grieving and for loss. In English-speaking countries now, we have Halloween or Samhain, if you follow more of a kind of Celtic earth-based tradition. And that's predominantly become known as the 31st October, like, you know, sweets and zombies fest. But it's a beautiful time to be able to explore themes of grief. And I think one of the things that's so poignant about it is that we gather with others. It can be around food. It can be as simple as lighting a candle. For things that you've lost, parts of yourself you might have lost, loved ones, it could be animals, trees, people you met, people you haven't met. It could even be things like the loss of a house, the loss of a career, like whatever it is. So finding ways to weave ceremony for grief, spaces in which you can hold that and be in community with others. And sometimes it's as simple as finding a song that you feel expresses something that you find it hard to put words to. So ceremony and grieving, very important too.
I'm just thinking about, not opening up a whole relationship to how we tend to avoid our grieving parts, you know.
Mm. Maybe there's a special episode just on that.
Yeah, I think it would be an important one. Again, back into the world of depth psychology, for people who are interested in that kind of teenage area and up, you know, the early psychoanalysts were really interested in childhood and kind of stopped it around puberty. Erik Erikson is a really interesting one. Identity in the Life Cycle talks about the different stages that can happen from teenagers on. And a really interesting book that addresses this idea about diagnosis. Alan Francis, a psychiatrist who was on the chair of the board for the DSM-4, which is the big diagnostic manual psychiatry in America, who quit the DSM-5 because he was so unhappy with how everything was being further pathologized, including prolonged grief. So when prolonged grief went into the DSM-5, he's like, okay, enough.
Wow.
He wrote this book called Saving Normal, which addresses some of the areas around overdiagnosis. And I think we can also,
especially in this day and age,
and how that sits uncomfortably aside this idea of neurodiversity. And there's a really interesting conversation to be had there. So that will be another one to look into.
I think I need to read that. It sounds fascinating.
It's really good. And it's really accessible, unlike the Sigmund Freud and the Julia Kristeva. Like, anybody can read Alan Francis's
book. So maybe start there. So closing remarks then.
I just want to thank him for his unrehearsed rawness. I mean, I always feel when I speak to Hamid that he just brings himself entirely forward and finds his way there with us, which I'm really grateful for. I really adore that transparency and openness.
Yeah. And I think especially for that piece around sensitivity and creativity and feeling, allowing yourself to feel and living in such a way that you help others to access that too. So,
and check him out, like go on YouTube and check out his work, for either from his earlier work in the band with Mashru Leila or his more independent stuff he's done recently. It's really soulful music. You'll really enjoy it.
Thanks for joining us, and time to show up. See you next time.
Bye-bye.